My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Hagritz, and we're back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we are talking about the Middle East from a Western Bubble perspective. Walter, why is that, and why are we not talking about Donald Trump?
Dear Western Bubble listeners, Dario here. We recorded this episode before the incident that took place in the Oval Office over the weekend between Trump, J.D. Vance, and Ukrainian President Zelensky. So this episode, we actually purposefully did not want to include anything about Donald Trump. So please forgive us that kind of the episode you listen to now will not be talking about this topic. However, we will be recording one on it this week and publish it actually a little bit earlier than next week. So we're very much looking forward to your feedback on this episode, and we hope that you forgive us. Thank you so much.
I think it is exactly time to stop talking about Trump for a little bit. I think we've done 3 episodes focused on him now. That's plenty. It's important not to lose track of the rest of the world, right? Our podcast is about the Western bubble. It's about the West. We're not experts on the Middle East itself, but we know that the West has enormous impact on the Middle East in the past and still today. And it's worth analyzing what is happening there right now.
However, unfortunately, we do need to quickly talk about Trump at the beginning of this episode because, and again, for transparency, it is the 26th of February. And just today, Trump posted a video on his personal social media platform, Truth Social. And it was an AI-generated video. It looked like it was created by a 12-year-old Elon Musk fanboy. And it depicted what Trump Gaza would look like, right? We spoke about this in the last episode, that Trump said he would turn Gaza into the Riviera of the Middle East. And this is what it would look like, right? And you see Elon Musk coming up in that video once in a while, and everyone dancing, high-risers. It basically looks like Dubai. And the video ends with Trump and Netanyahu laying together at the beach. Truly disturbing on all levels.
Yes, I mean, it's a very unpleasant video, and it's not that far away from statements that were made in the past. Having said that, this is exactly what we mentioned last week, right? That we have to be careful with Trump derangement syndrome, in the sense that every time something annoying happens or something unpleasant happens, that we jump at it. Because that's exactly what happened during the first term of Trump. Liberals would criticize every little statement, every little thing that he did, every like for an unpleasant post. And the result is that the world got flooded with so much criticism of Trump that we actually forgot to pay attention when it really matters. Now, these past couple of weeks have really mattered when it comes to Trump. The choices he makes with respect to the United States foreign policy, the way that the United States sees itself and the rest of the world, the impact on Ukraine, potentially the impact on Gaza. We have to be careful not to start spending enormous amounts of time and energy on relatively small details, such as which video does he like. Symbolically, it's ugly, but it's just a like, or just a repost of something. It actually is not a policy initiative by itself.
The Trump derangement syndrome. Have you written a paper about this yet so that you will be the father of this term?
I wish I could claim ownership of that, but it's something that has existed for quite a long time. I'm just using the phrase in this context, right? And it specifically has been used to criticize those liberal TV channels that during the first presidency kept on going on and on and on, day after day after day, about every little thing that he said or done. Look, we've established that, at least from my perspective, that he is an unpleasant character. We've established that he is having a huge impact on the way the world operates because of his deviation from traditional US foreign policy. We don't need to remind ourselves about our opinions all the time. You've made up your mind about Donald Trump, and let's move on from there.
In this regard, I think it's a very good habit that you usually have of not watching anything, but only reading about it, because it does remove you a little bit from the immediate action and reaction. If you give yourself, I don't know, let's say 24 hours to mentally react to something that you've read and not watched.
We know this from study after study, right? That if you read things, your way of processing is very different. It is calmer, it is less emotional, and it allows you to actually stay away from getting angry, getting upset that easily. That doesn't mean that you take the content less seriously. It just means that you process it differently. And it also, for example, allows you to observe things when about certain characters when they do something positive. For example, there are signs that the Trump administration is now putting pressure on the Pentagon to cut its budget. Well, that is excellent, right? I think that's good news. And the fact that I don't see video after video about Donald Trump means that I can give him credit where it's due, because I don't have his orange face in my in my thoughts all the time.
The orange face in your phone all the time. Well, let's go away from the orange face in our phones and in your ears, talking to the listeners. And let's move to the Middle East. Today we want to talk about three and a half different topics or countries. Right? We will start out with Israel, we will continue with Syria, and we will finish it with how close is the Republic, Islamic Republic of Iran this time to the nuclear bomb.
Yeah, finish our podcast and the world, as it looks like, if you follow the media. Yeah,
basically, right? I mean, I think we could cut that part short by just asking our listeners to listen again to episode number 2, where we spoke about the Iran nuclear deal for the first time, and not a lot has changed since, except that they are this close, right? Very, very.
Yeah. So not a lot has changed also since 1981, when that was when they started being this close, really, really close to nuclear weapons. Yeah.
But let's start with the topic of Israel, because we haven't actually looked at Israel and at Gaza in a while, right? We were pretty busy with the U.S. elections in the kind of remainder of 2024. And we have been pretty busy with the results of the US elections at the beginning of 2025. And there was also our 100th episode. So we were very busy with that. And in that process, we haven't really spoken about Israel a lot from a Western bubble perspective, right? And so if I had to kind of summarize the past few weeks, we've seen a lot of prisoner exchanges. So between hostages that were taken on October 7th in 2023 and prisoners, right, imprisoned Palestinians that Israel has taken as prisoners over the past few years, but also in the past 2 years, specifically during their military operation invasion of Gaza. And Balder, unfortunately, I didn't follow your advice there, and I watched the videos. Right, so I each time I watched how Hamas operatives basically paraded the hostages around before releasing them to the Red Cross, and I must say that when you watch these videos, I almost have I do have sympathy for the Israelis who kind of take that bait and become even more angry and enraged at Hamas and the whole topic, right? Because it makes you feel pretty angry. And then I think I understand Israelis who are closer to the topic, who are watching this and are just feeling very enraged. And with this, kind of falling victims to the Western bubble.
Yeah, it's an incredibly unpleasant spectacle. Again, I haven't watched that many videos for the reasons you mentioned before, but it is a very unpleasant situation. And this is something that's really important to remember, right? In our podcast, I think we've been rightfully mostly criticizing Israel for the past year. The past year, over past year and 3 months, have been incredibly destructive. But it is still important to remember that on that day in October 2023, not only were over 1,000 people murdered, hundreds of prisoners were kidnapped, and since then have been in undoubtedly very unpleasant circumstances. To finish that up then with being paraded back to Israel like that, back to the Red Cross, it's just ugly. It's the ugliest side of humanity, and we should have no sympathy for any of that. Now, the problem in this conflict is that immediately when we say something like that, or certainly the way that you introduced it, some people are going to say, yeah, but this is exactly the humiliation that Israel inflicts upon Palestinians day after day, month after month, year after year. And so it becomes a both-siderism thing again. And some people will unfortunately feel some kind of satisfaction about, oh, now we're getting even, right? This is how we have felt for all this time. And now the Israelis also experience the humiliation that that we have suffered through. It's it's humanity at its ugliest. It is what it is. I must say, on a positive note, that it's surprising that it is still, in a fragile way, still working, the ceasefire. That we're still here. I wouldn't have been surprised if by now it would have somehow collapsed from either side, right? So that the fact that there's still this exchange and the two sides are still talking after the enormous destruction is kind of a net positive, I guess.
I mean, is the ceasefire still holding? Because, I mean, officially, yes, but there are a lot of accusations, particularly against Israel, that this is not the case, right? That there are, like, Israel is still killing people in Gaza, and it's allowing fewer food trucks and basic aid into Gaza than agreed upon in the agreement.
Yeah, so, I mean, there have been accusations from both sides, and certainly it seems that Israel is not respecting all the terms, but at least we haven't returned to the violent days of 2-3 months ago, right? We're not in the situation where both sides are at it. Now, you could say that is because Hamas is recovering and no longer has the ability to do anything, maybe. It's true that Israel has always been the dominant actor and the ceasefire would mostly depend on Israel. And so Israel can sort of push the boundaries. But I think that at least the situation is a little bit less worrisome for people living in Gaza than it was 3-4 months ago. And that's certainly something to, you know, if not positive about, at least to try to hold on to, that there's at least a little bit of stability which had been so absent for over a year.
And on all of this, I'm seeing very little reactions by Western Europe, right? Well, not by the West and Europe, right, in particular. The United States, I think we can talk about in a second, but from European countries, all I'm hearing and seeing is a statement every time basically hostages are released, saying that, oh, we're so happy that they're home, but at the same time, Hamas actions are despicable, right? It seems like the whole Israel-Gaza topic has really lost all areas of interest for Europe.
Yeah, it's lost momentum, it's lost hype. Welcome to international relations. This is how it always goes. Ask Ukrainians the difference between the first 3 months of the invasion and now 3 years later, how they feel about it. It is a continuous kind of pattern where people get all hyped up, all emotional, all connected. And at some point that emotion runs dry. People get on with their own lives, they cannot be bothered. But also, and that's a slightly more problematic aspect of this, is that European politicians kind of got it wrong early on, right? They got it wrong in essentially giving Israel a free pass to do whatever they liked under the Western bubble kind of phrasing of a democracy has a right to defend itself against terrorism, as if a phrase like that has any meaning or any value. And it took them a number of months to understand what the Netanyahu government was actually doing and was planning to do in the future. Then slowly European politicians started backtracking, but that was a very slow, painfully slow process. And it is now something that they'd prefer not to be reminded of anymore. And they'd rather not be bothered about it and not to be asked about it, because they were in some ways very much complicit to the enormous destruction and pain and suffering that was caused afterwards, right? Just like people in Europe no longer, at least leaders in Europe, don't want to be reminded of how Europe behaved during the war on terror. You know, initially it was exactly the same reaction to the United States, right? Hey, we're with you, 9/11, horrific, we will support you no matter what. And now, from 2025's perspective, the war on terror was an enormous humanitarian disaster inflicted by Western nations. And ask any politician about it, and they very quickly would like to change the topic.
Are we going to see a similar pattern of reactions to the situation in Lebanon, where particularly European countries were very excited about Israel taking out Hezbollah? They were a bit more defensive already about giving Israel a blank check, but they were ultimately pretty happy with the result, the fact that the entire Hezbollah leadership has been taken out, and the fact that that new Lebanese government, right, is basically forming without significant influence of Hezbollah as of now. because we also saw the funeral of the right former leader of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, who was killed by an Israeli airstrike. And there were tens of thousands of people cheering, right, or like basically attending that funeral in sympathy of Hezbollah. And it kind of seems like that this quick and easy solution to a quote-unquote terrorist organization, meaning violence and killing the entire leadership, that's not really a sustainable model.
So this is the obvious logical analysis that any first-year student of international relations can make, but for some reason, at the higher levels of policymaking and media coverage, that is forgotten. You can damage terrorist organizations by killing leadership. Right now, I think it's fair to say that both Hamas and Hezbollah are licking their wounds. Hezbollah probably even more than Hamas, because Hamas still occupies a certain political space. Hezbollah is sort of has retreated, right, for now. So you can damage these terrorist organizations, but they are immortal in terms of actually eradication. You can't get rid of them through this violence. The only way to get rid of them is to take away their long-term support. And if anything, this past year and a half has only increased sympathy for Hezbollah and Hamas, not just in local countries, but also worldwide, right? So there will be lots of Lebanese who were very happy to see Hezbollah sort of punished, right? Because Hezbollah is definitely not universally supported in Lebanon, quite the opposite. And this was also one of the reasons why the Lebanese government was kind of a little bit ambiguous in how they went about it, despite the fact that their territory was invaded, their Westphalian sovereignty was violated by Israel. But at least it went against a political opponent. So in the short term, it seemed to actually have some positive impact. But in the long run, you only increase the danger that's coming from these organizations. The only way to make sure that organizations such as Hezbollah or Hamas, or even more explicit terrorist organizations such as Al-Qaeda, right, because they're not exactly symmetrical, they're not exactly the same, will disappear from Earth and will stop using terrorist tactics, is to actually deal with the underlying grievances that exist and that makes young men, it's almost always men, turn to these organizations out of anger, out of suffering, out of darkness, right? And that is a long-term proposition. And in that sense, the past year and a half has only helped these organizations.
Oh, so you think that dropping bombs on people's houses, killing their loved ones, their fathers, right, in particular, kind of destroying their livelihoods, kind of taking, right, taking that away, taking their rights away, treating them as second-class citizens, that's not a healthy and conducive way to solve these underlying issues? It seems like the West has been trying this for 20 years, so it must somehow work, right?
Yeah, I know, Dario. I'm a radical, weird thinker who always thinks outside of the box. And, you know, I say these strange things that killing people is maybe not the best way to make them your friend. Yeah, it's so obvious, right? It's so completely clear. The one thing that is true is that if you kill leadership, then these organizations need to retreat for a while. And maybe sometimes even turn into another organization, right? If it's deemed that an organization itself is no longer viable or has some bad connotations, then people move on to something else. But it's important to realize that the reason why they exist has to be dealt with. And as long as you don't deal with those reasons, there are always going to be people willing to commit terrorist acts, willing to commit violence against what they perceive as oppression, injustice, etc.
Do we still want to talk about the United States here? Because with Europe, the situation is, I think, one of slow and painful realization. With the current administration in the United States, I think it's the opposite, right? They were the ones who very heavily pushed for a new government to form without Hezbollah in Lebanon. They're the ones who are pushing for the Riviera of the Middle East. Do we see a difference there in behavior, or is it ultimately just a difference in kind of, right, in the statements, the public statements, but the mindset is still the same?
Well, no, if you take Trump out of the equation, even then the United States has always been a more active participant in these kinds of things than Europe. In some ways, And with all due respect, because I work with a lot of Europeans who are involved in this kind of policymaking, Europeans tend to be a little bit useless. You know, they don't have a particularly strong approach either way. They facilitate, certainly over the past year and a half, they facilitated a lot of the destruction that has taken place, and they're not being held accountable for that because European populations in the end don't really care much. But they typically are much less of an active participant than Washington, than the United States. The United States has always more of a gung-ho kind of approach to these things, trying to get involved, trying to pull the strings, that kind of thing. Certainly in the case with Israel. And that is the case without Trump. That has been the case under Biden, that has been the case under Obama, George W. Bush, you can go down the whole list of presidencies. Now, with Trump, the interesting question at the beginning of his term, before he occupied the White House again, was to what extent is he concerned about Saudi Arabia? To what extent is he going to care about him? We knew that he had sympathy for Netanyahu. He likes people like Netanyahu. He likes all. It's not an ideological thing. It's not an ethnic thing. It's not a religious thing. It is simply an alpha male thing. It is. He likes Netanyahu just like he likes Erdogan, like he likes Putin. He likes Kim Jong-un, which I always find a little bit of a weird outsider because I wouldn't call Kim Jong-un an alpha male, but okay. He likes those kinds of men. But there were some reasons to think that he would be careful on Israel because Saudi Arabia has sway over the White House. He has deals with Saudi Arabia. They have a close relationship. Now, it turns out that Saudi Arabia doesn't really care. It turns out that Saudi Arabia has told the Americans, has told the Trump administration, you know, we're gonna puff and sigh a little bit, and we're going to sometimes put out a statement that we don't agree with everything that you're doing, but you get it, go on, we won't punish you for it, we will continue to talk with you, we want to be your ally, because the House of Saud simply is interested in its own survival, and it believes that Trump can support it in that with that objective. So once that became clear that Saudi Arabia was okay with Trump going full pro-Israel, that's exactly the path that they went down, and you see the result. You see how the language has shifted and how Palestinians essentially don't exist in Trump's mindset, right? So the aggressive attitude that the United States typically has already is now amplified by Trump's complete identification with the Israelis, with a strong military force, with strong alpha males such as Netanyahu, versus what he perceives, and this is important, he perceives to be Palestinian losers, those who do not have armed forces, those who seem too different from him, those he cannot relate to, just as he has very little sympathy for other such rebel groups around the world.
You just mentioned different groups like Hezbollah and Hamas licking their wounds, that one country that has been supporting them is also licking its wounds right now, because not only has Iran lost influence in Gaza and in Lebanon because of the state that those two groups are in right now, but we see the same in Syria. Right, a topic that we also briefly spoke about last year, with the kind of removal of a long-term dictator Assad, who was also right. I think we called him a real asshole in that one episode. Right, just a really bad guy. Where I think no one can say his departure is anything like. It might be anything negative.
You must have called him that, Dario, because I don't use such crude language, obviously.
Well, I do when people deserve it. And I think with Assad, I can comfortably say that without having to apologize to my mother. Let's talk about Syria and its new leadership, because it's actually very interesting, right? The different things that we see and how quickly all of this is happening, right? We already spoke in past episodes of how quickly things are changing. And I think Syria is one of those examples where, the pace at which things are happening is incredible, because al-Gulani was invited to an emergency meeting by the Arab League in Egypt, right? Which shows how fast this man has been rehabilitated regionally, and we'll quickly, in a moment, talk about how he has been rehabilitated internationally.
Yeah, and in some ways, this is the same pattern that we just discussed about Israel. Syria is a conflict that has been raging for well over a decade, and arguably longer if you take earlier conflicts into account. And it is very clear that the world, the region, but also, for example, Europeans and Americans are tired of it. So this was a moment that Assad went. This was bad news for Iran, relatively bad news for Russia, even though Russia is trying to still maintain some presence there. But it allowed the rest of the world to take a break and to say, okay, now let's normalize relations. We can't continue this. And what's interesting about that is that foundationally, the current government in Syria is very much not aligned with Western powers, but even Egypt. There are significant problems there. There are significant long-term issues that are not being dealt with, but nobody wants to deal with them because everyone wants to pretend that things can go back to normal. And I must give it to the Syrian government that they're actually playing that game very, very well. They know what not to do. They know not to stir the hornet's nest. They understand that the rest of the world is desperate for an excuse to basically normalize this situation, normalize relations, and that they've got a golden opportunity, therefore, to take control of a country that, by the way, they still are not fully controlling. Let's be clear about that. So credit to them. They're playing the game very, very well. They get integrated into those international dynamics. However, as a policy advisor, I would like to point out that the actual long-term dynamics do not provide a foundation for peace and prosperity. At some point, this is going to come back as a problem, as a source of conflict. This is going to be a geopolitical thing again.
But that's not what Western media is writing about. Because what they are writing about is that a few months ago, the German and British, and I think the French foreign minister, collectively visited Syria. And there, the big upset was not the fact that they went, not the fact that they didn't address long-term dynamics, but that Al-Gulani wouldn't shake the hand of a woman, of the German foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock. That was the main topic that everyone focused on during that time.
Yeah, this goes back to that focus on details, right? So we have established that they, just like you could do the same with Iran, you could do the same with Afghanistan. We know about how they approach things and how that doesn't fit into our liberal perspective on the world. And that means, for example, problematic relationship with women, at least from our perspective. Now, however, in the bigger picture, who cares? I mean, it's not that shaking of the hand is not a problem, right? It's something that we already knew, and it just confirms something we already know. Why would we actually spend time on that? Instead of focusing on the actual underlying issues, we look at symbolism, and it's incredibly frustrating that continues. That is where sort of, if I hate using this word because I still don't know what it really means, but where wokeness shows its ugly side, right? Where it is all about the image rather than about the underlying reality. And this is a very good case of that. Now, what I just find fascinating is that nobody is actually interested in either saying, okay, we now need to learn the lessons of leaving Syria alone, or we need to deal with the problems that the Syrian government/regime poses to us.
Yeah, but Walter, one second, because you know, you compared this new government in Syria to kind of the Taliban.
Well, I mean, there are significant differences, right?
yeah, there is, right? But because the Vatican News, they just published an article saying that women and minorities attend the Syrian National Dialogue Conference. I mean, the Vatican seems to be pretty representative of the West, if you ask me, right? And they seem to be fine with the new Syrian government. So why shouldn't we?
Yeah, so this is exactly it. We're desperately trying to find signs that everything is going to be okay because we desperately want to avoid creating a new conflict, having to worry about Syria again. We've mismanaged it over and over again. Now we don't want to manage it at all, which in itself is perfectly fine with me. But let's not pretend that Syria is ever going to be a ally or a support to Western policymakers. It's not. No, they don't have to be. But now we're just pretending that everything is fine. And every time there is some kind of sign that women are are sort of benefiting from this new government structure, from the new reality in Syria. We jump at it. And every time that you actually look at the foundation of the country and the government, that shows that actually this is not in any way a reprieve for women from a liberal Western perspective, we ignore it. That's how we work, because we don't want to think about it. And it's rather unpleasant, but it is how the West works over and over again.
You know, this always, well, at the moment, this makes me a little bit angry. Right, the fact that the Western media focuses on not shaking hands, right, or that women and minorities can attend this, but that the more impactful things, the things that are impacting everyday Syrians in Syria, are not being talked about, right? And this is one of the moments when my quasi-pacifist right self comes out, because the West could do something, right, that that doesn't support that government in any way, shape, or form, right? It doesn't legitimize them and so on and so forth, right? But it would actually help Syrians, and that is maybe send some troops, some material to Syria to actually help them with ammunition that hasn't exploded, and that's killing on average somewhere between 20 and 30 people in Syria every week, right? And the fact that, first of all, that number isn't really being reported on, that's one of the experts that I follow on social media on Syria, he's the one who reports on this, but that you won't hear about this in the like mainstream media. I can't believe I'm using that term. So that's the case, right? That's a real problem. That's something that everyday Syrians are facing. A lot of them are dying because of it. And I think there's a quick and easy solution to this, right? Where you could actually send some specialists down there with some technology. But that's not within our interest. No, we would rather focus on not shaking hands and returning refugees.
Yeah, it's fascinating. When you said send some troops, I said, Dario, what have happened? Why? I thought the whole Western bubble was about not sending troops, but then you followed it up with basically arguing for anti-landmine experts and that kind of thing. Yeah, this is over and over again the thing. And the same could be applied to Iran, the same could be applied to Afghanistan. If you really care about local populations, you can do business with those governments. And those governments are happy with certain. I'm sure that the current Syrian government would be delighted if the West helped with removing all those explosive devices from its lands. If they were, to de-landmine, if that is a word, it's not a word, but I'm just making it a word, de-landmine the country, de-bomb the country. Those are things that everyone wants. But of course, that is expensive, that is tricky, that is politically sensitive, and so the West doesn't do it. It's much easier to leave this issue hanging, to ignore it for now. And here is the really, really upsetting thing. At some point, it is going to be useful again for the West to pinpoint at these issues and to say this is a reason to start intervening into Syria again. At some point, the word human rights will become popular again when they want to apply to Syria, and it becomes a door that can be opened in order to militarily intervene, try to overthrow the regime, etc. That moment will be the moment that the current government becomes too close to, for example, Russia, or becomes too aggressively anti-Western or something like that. So that is the dark, dark side of the Western bubble, right? Not really caring about the local population, but invoking human rights abuses and those kinds of things when it is geopolitically convenient.
Exactly, right? When it's geopolitically convenient. But when, for example, Israel moves into Syria with tanks and regularly bombs Syria, then the West is quiet. Right, because al-Golani actually kind of demanded the departure of Israeli troops from Syria, and as a response, the Israeli military bombed military targets in southern Syria outside Damascus just hours right after he called for it. What a coincidence!
I mean, we've talked about how Israel has completely ignored and just almost forgotten about any international rules and just violates Westphalian territory left, right, and center whenever it's in their interest. And it's absolutely fascinating how Western countries are basically pretending that that's okay, that it's not happening. You know, how is it possible that in 2025 we live in a world where a country that is not being attacked by another country just drives into another Westphalian territory, occupies its space, bombs left, right, and center, puts military bases there, and nobody cares about it. It is a bizarre, bizarre situation. And it just shows how hypocritical and ridiculous the West has become in this regard.
But maybe the West will move on Iran, because Iran is this close, Walder, this close to developing a nuclear bomb.
Yeah. That's very worrying news. So, I mean, maybe we need to start building our nuclear shelters and all that. I've been mentally preparing for this since 1981, because in 1981, the first report came out that it was this close. So now we're really this close. Come on. This is complete. How often have we heard these stories? Look, there might be one day, it might be tomorrow, it might be 10 years down the line, that we actually get news from Iran itself that they've developed nuclear weapons. That's absolutely a possibility. They deny it. They've continuously said that it goes against their faith, but that day might come. It has worked for North Korea. It might work for Iran. But until that day, it is insane how often these stories repeat themselves. I mean, this could be a cut and paste story from 2016. It could be one from 2002. It could be one from 1995. It could be one from 1983. It doesn't matter. These stories have come up over and over again, and it's just insanity. It's just repeating the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, but Boulder, one second, aren't you? I think you're being a little bit too harsh, because since November of 2024, Iran has increased its uranium that has enriched up to 60% by 92.5 kilograms. That's a lot, and that's very small. Like, right, and this article here says it. That's a very short, like, technical step away from weapons grade levels of 90%.
Here, it's really good not to be an expert on nuclear weapons, because I've got no idea whether 92 kilograms is a lot or not, and I don't care, because these claims were made over and over again in the past. First of all, the way I understand it, having weapons-grade uranium doesn't mean that they're actually going to have weapons. It means that they've got weapon-grade uranium. I think there's a very reasonable analysis that says that Iran uses this to extract concessions from the West, like the threat, right? And the West sort of all the time steps into it, like, oh, we have to be careful, we have to limit Iran. Okay, we're willing to lift some sanctions if you reduce your uranium production. We're willing to give you something in exchange for something else. I'm telling you that until the day that Iran itself declares that it has nuclear weapons, or there is complete, clear, and convincing evidence that they have from the outside, not some whether they've got weapons-grade uranium or anything like that, but that they actually have nuclear weapons that can be used in a military, aggressive, destructive way, until that day, I'm not interested, because we've been here over and over again, and my head hurts from repeating this kind of thing over and over again.
What is really interesting to me is how accurate those numbers are, because it shows that the International Atomic Energy Agency still has access to Iran and regularly monitors this, because again, if you wanted to do this in secret, you would obviously not invite the agency to regularly report on how much near weapons grade uranium you have, right?
Well, I can absolutely, but I can only repeat the case of Iraq, right? The UN was present in Iraq with their search for weapons of mass destruction in 2001, 2002. Over and over again, the UN said, this is what we found, and it's basically nothing. There are no weapons of mass destruction except for this, this, and that. The United States invades based on the idea that Iraq is developing weapons of mass destruction, whether it's nuclear or chemical or whatever. Afterwards, what did they find? That the UN knew exactly, correctly what was present in Iraq. It is fascinating, right? These countries, Iraq in 2002 or in 2003, Iran now and over the past 40 years have been completely monitored and very accurately, it has been predicted what they can and cannot do. How come that we sort of try to ignore that and try to create a narrative that Iran in the future is going to kill us all? Now, I'm still fascinated by the by the speculation on behalf of people like Kenneth Waltz, a famous IR theorist, that it actually wouldn't be that bad for Iran to develop nuclear weapons because it would create some kind of stability. I don't know where my position is in that debate. I think it's an interesting thought process, but nuclear proliferation as a general rule is probably not the right way to go. However, at a very minimum, can we stop repeating this process over and over again? It's stupid, it's silly, and the media should know better by now.
Well, luckily, we have recorded an episode, actually two episodes, on nuclear proliferation. So I do invite all of our listeners to go and listen to them, because I remember making an argument that nuclear weapons actually make the world a little bit safer.
No, and that is a very serious and interesting argument. I find it difficult. I mean, sometimes I just don't have a strong opinion because I can see both sides of it, and it's the answer is somewhere probably in the middle. But there is a reason why India and Pakistan haven't gotten into any significant wars since they both developed nuclear weapons. There were skirmishes, there was a bit of violence here and there, but nothing like the wars that they fought previously before nuclear weapons took place. There's a reason why things have stabilized around North Korea because it has nuclear weapons. There's a reason why the Soviet Union and the United States never got into a war during the Cold War, an open war during the Cold War, because they knew it would lead to nuclear destruction. And then there's, on top of that, there is, of course, the continued hypocrisy. Here is the United States, the country with the most advanced nuclear weapons, the only country in the world to ever use nuclear weapons aggressively against an enemy in Japan at the end of the Second World War, that is lecturing Iran on what it can and cannot do. There are so many reasons to stop this obsession with uranium and Iran. If they develop nuclear weapons, then we'll deal with that then. If they don't, they don't. Just move on and focus on more important things.
Well, for anyone interested, those two episodes that we recorded are episode 29 and 30, and we actually published them exactly 2 years ago, on the 28th of February, 2023. Balder, we've now talked about like three and a half, right, case studies and countries. The West, particularly under Donald Trump and his first term, kind of pulled out of the Middle East. But we're still talking about the West being involved in the Middle East, right? So it's no longer so much as like boots on the grounds, but it's more in the direction of the West still feels the need to comment on the Middle East at any chance it gets.
Yeah, it is, the West has this very complex psychological relationship with the Middle East, right? It has literally a millennium of conflict with the Middle East, even a little bit more than that, than a millennium. And if you go back to Roman times, it's even 2,000 years. The Middle East holds a special place in Western thinking. Now, it's completely obvious, and this is a good thing for the world, for the Middle East, but for everyone around the Middle East as well, that the West has essentially become a side player in Middle Eastern politics. It absolutely lost influence and power. And regional powers such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey are way more important than they ever were, which is a good thing. But the West can't help talking about it, for one, because there are still strategic interests, right? And it would be interesting to see what, in a parallel universe, what would have happened if Israel had never been created, because a lot of the concerns about the Middle East and the West are connected to Israel. But even if you take that aside, Europeans and Americans have this very unhealthy obsession with the Middle East and with trying to interfere in those local societies. And I think it's not going to be easy to take that out of our psyche, because we grew up like that. It's maybe not nature, but certainly through nurture, we are told that the Middle East is our backyard and we have some kind of divine right to have opinions on it and to be active there.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the Middle East and the Western bubble. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Well, talking about this obsession that the West has with the Middle East and the very unhealthy tendency to interfere when they should just stay out, is of course very nicely represented in Orientalism, the book by our good friend Edward Said, and I say good friend because we've quoted him in the past. And specifically, I thought this was a suitable quote for today's episode. It goes, "In newsreels or news photos, the Arab is always shown in large numbers. No individuality, no personal characteristics or experiences. Most of the pictures represent mass rage and misery or irrational, hence hopelessly eccentric, gestures. Lurking behind all of these images is the menace of jihad, consequence, a fear that the Muslims or Arabs will take over the world."